This is definitely what you want? He was looking at me keenly with an expression that made me feel like I was on the witness stand. To be at Mr. Hobart's for the next few weeks? I didn't like the sound of the next few weeks.
Yes,
I said into my fist.
But
because boarding school... He folded his hands and leaned back in his chair and regarded me.
Almost certainly the best thing for you in the long term, but quite frankly, given the situation, I believe I could telephone my friend Sam Ungerer at Buckfield, and we could get you up there right now. Something could be arranged. It's an excellent school, and I think it would be possible to arrange for you to stay in the home of the headmaster or one of the teachers, rather than the dormitory, so you could be in more of a family setting, if you thought that would be something you'd like.
He and Hobie were both looking at me, encouragingly, as I thought. I stared at my shoes, not wanting to seem ungrateful, but wishing that this line of suggestion would go away.
Well,
Mr. Bracegirdle and Hobie exchanged a glance. Was I wrong to see a hint of resignation and or disappointment in Hobie's expression?
As long as this is what you want, and Mr. Hobart's amenable, I see nothing wrong with this arrangement for the time being. But I do urge you to think about where you'd like to be, Theodore, so we can go ahead and work out something for the next school term, or maybe even summer school, if you'd like.
7. Temporary guardianship. In the next weeks, I did my best to buckle down and not think too much about what temporary might mean. I'd applied to an early college program in the city, my reasoning being that it would keep me from being shipped out to the sticks if for some reason things at Hobie's didn't work. All day in my room, under a weak lamp, as Popchick snoozed on the carpet by my feet, I spent hunched over test preparation booklets, memorizing dates, proofs, theorems, Latin vocabulary words, so many irregular verbs in Spanish that even in my dreams I looked down the lines of long tables and despaired of keeping them straight. It was as if I was trying to punish myself, maybe even make things up to my mother, by setting my sights so high. I'd fallen out of the habit of doing schoolwork. It wasn't exactly as if I'd kept up my studies in Vegas, and the sheer amount of material to memorize gave me a feeling of torture. Lights turned in the face, not knowing the correct answer, catastrophe if I failed. Rubbing my eyes, trying to keep myself awake with cold showers and iced coffee, I goaded myself on by reminding myself what a good thing I was doing, though my endless cramming felt a lot more like self-destruction than any glue-sniffing I'd ever done. And at some bleary point, the work itself became a kind of drug that left me so drained that I could hardly take in my surroundings. And yet I was grateful for the work, because it kept me too mentally bludgeoned to think. The shame that tormented me was all the more corrosive for having no very clear origin. I didn't know why I felt so tainted and worthless and wrong, only that I did. And whenever I looked up from my books, I was swamped by slimy waters rushing in from all sides. Part of it had to do with the painting. I knew nothing good would come of keeping it, and yet I also knew I'd kept it too long to speak up. Confiding in Mr. Bracegirdle was foolhardy. My position was too precarious. He was already champing at the bit to send me to boarding school. And when I thought, as I often did, of confiding in Hobie, I found myself drifting into various theoretical scenarios, none of which seemed any more or less probable than the others. I would give the painting to Hobie, and he would say, "Oh, no big deal." And somehow, I had problems with this part, the logistics of it, he would take care of it, or phone some people he knew, or have a great idea about what to do or something, and not care, or be mad, and somehow it would all be fine. Or, I would give the painting to Hobie, and he would call the police. Or, I would give the painting to Hobie, and he would take the painting for himself and then say, "What, are you crazy? Painting? I don't know what you're talking about." Or, I would give the painting to Hobie, and he would nod and look sympathetic and tell me I'd done the right thing, but then as soon as I was out of the room, he would phone his own lawyer, and I would be dispatched to boarding school or a juvenile home, which, painting or not, was where most of my scenarios ended up anyway. But by far the greater part of unease had to do with my father. I knew that his death wasn't my fault, and yet on a bone-deep, irrational, completely unshakable level, I also knew that it was.
Given how coldly I'd walked away from him in his final despair,
the fact that he'd lied was beside the point. Maybe he'd known that it was in my power to pay his debt, a fact which had haunted me since Mr. Bracegirdle had so lightly let it slip. In the shadows beyond the desk lamp, Hobie's terracotta griffins stared at me with beady glass eyes. Did he think I'd stiffed him on purpose? That I wanted him to die? At night, I dreamed of him beaten and chased through casino parking lots, and more than once awoke with a jolt to him sitting in the chair by my bed and observing me quietly, the coal of his cigarette glowing in the dark. "But they told me you died," I said aloud, before realizing he wasn't there. Without Pippa, the house was deathly quiet. The closed-off, formal rooms smelled faint and damp like dead leaves. I mooned about looking at her things, wondering where she was and what she was doing, and trying hard to feel connected to her by such tenuous threads as a red hair in the bathtub drain or a balled-up sock under the sofa. But as much as I missed the nervous tingle of her presence, I was soothed by the house, its sense of safety and enclosure. Old portraits and poorly lit hallways, loudly ticking clocks. It was as if I'd signed on as a cabin boy on the Marie Celeste. Moving about through the stagnant silences, the pools of shadow and deep sun, the old floors creaked underfoot like the deck of a ship, the wash of traffic out on Sixth Avenue breaking just audibly against the ear. Upstairs, puzzling lightheaded over differential equations, Newton's law of cooling, independent variables, we have used the fact that ambient temperature is constant to eliminate its derivative. Hobie's presence below stairs was an anchor, a friendly weight. I was comforted to hear the tap of his mallet floating up from below, and to know that he was down there pottering quietly with his tools and his spirit gums and varicolored woods. With the barbers, my lack of pocket money had been a continual worry. Having always to hit Mrs. Barber up for lunch money, lab fees at school, and other small expenses had occasioned dread and anxiety quite out of proportion to the sums she carelessly disbursed. But my living stipend from Mr. Bracegirdle made me feel a lot less awkward about throwing myself down in Hobie's household, unannounced. I was able to pay Popchick's vet bills, a small fortune since he had bad teeth and a mild case of heartworm. Xandra, to my knowledge, never having given him a pill or taken him for shots my whole time in Vegas. I was also able to pay my own dentist bills, which were considerable. 6 fillings, 10 hellish hours in the dentist chair, and buy myself a laptop and an iPhone, as well as the shoes and winter clothes I needed. And, though Hobie wouldn't accept grocery money, still I went out and got groceries for him all the same, groceries I paid for. Milk and sugar and washing powder from Grand Union, but more often fresh produce from the farmer's market at Union Square, wild mushrooms and wine-sap apples, raisin bread, small luxuries which seemed to please him, unlike the large containers of Tide which he looked at sadly and took to the pantry without a word. It was all very different from the crowded, complicated, and overly formal atmosphere of the barber's, where everything was rehearsed and scheduled like a Broadway production, an airless perfection from which Andy had been in constant retreat, scuttling to his bedroom like a frightened squid. By contrast, Hobie lived and wafted like some great sea mammal in his own mild atmosphere, the dark brown of tea stains and tobacco, where every clock in the house said something different, and time didn't actually correspond to the standard measure, but instead meandered along at its own sedate tick-tock, obeying the pace of his antique crowded backwater, far from the factory-built, epoxy-glued version of the world. Though he enjoyed going out to the movies, there was no television, He read old novels with marbled end papers. He didn't own a cell phone. His computer, a prehistoric IBM, was the size of a suitcase and useless. In blameless quiet, he buried himself in his work, steam-bending veneers or hand-threading table legs with a chisel, and his happy absorption floated up from the workshop and diffused through the house with the warmth of a wood-burning stove in winter. He was absent-minded and kind. He was neglectful and muddle-headed and self-deprecating and gentle. Often, he didn't hear the first time you called downstairs to him, or even the second time. He lost his glasses, mislaid his wallet, his keys, his dry cleaning tickets, and was always calling me downstairs to get down on my hands and knees with him to help him search for some minuscule fitting or piece of hardware he'd dropped on the floor. Occasionally, he opened the store by appointment, for an hour or two at a time, but, as far as I could tell, this was little more than an excuse to bring out the bottle of sherry and visit with friends and acquaintances, and if he showed a piece of furniture, opening and shutting drawers to oohs and ahs, it seemed to be mostly in the spirit in which Andy and I, once upon a time, had dragged out our toys for show and tell. If he ever actually sold a piece, I never saw him do it. His bailiwick, as he called it, was the workshop, or the hospital, rather, where the crippled chairs and tables stood stacked, awaiting his care. Like a gardener occupied with greenhouse specimens, brushing aphids from individual plant leaves, he absorbed himself in the texture and grain of individual pieces, the hidden drawers, the scars, and marvels. Though he owned a few pieces of modern woodworking equipment, a router, a cordless drill, and a circular saw, he seldom used them. "If it requires earplugs, I haven't much call for it." He went down there early and sometimes, if he had a project, stayed down there after dark. But generally, when the light started to go, he came upstairs, and before washing up for dinner, poured himself the same inch of whiskey, neat, in a small tumbler. Tired, congenial, lamp black on his hands, something rough and soldierly in his fatigue. "Has he taken you out to dinner?" Pippa texted me. "Yes, like 3 or 4 times. He only likes to go to empty restaurants where nobody goes." "That's right. The place he took me last week was like King Tut's tomb." "Yes, he only goes places where he feels sorry for the owners, because he is scared they will go out of business, and then he will feel guilty." "I like it better when he cooks. Ask him to make gingerbread for you. I wish I had some now." Dinner was the time of day I looked forward to most. In Vegas, especially after Boris had taken up with Kotku, I'd never gotten used to the sadness of having to scrabble around to feed myself at night, sitting on the side of my bed with a bag of potato chips or maybe a dried-up container of rice left over from my dad's carryout. By happy contrast, Hobie's whole day revolved around dinner. "Where shall we eat? Who's coming over? What shall I cook? Do you like pot-au-feu? No? Never had it? Lemon rice or saffron? Fig preserves or apricot? Do you want to walk over to Jefferson Market with me?" Sometimes on Sundays there were guests, who among New School and Columbia professors, opera orchestra and preservation society ladies, and various old dears from up and down the street, also included a great many dealers and collectors of all stripes, from batty old ladies in fingerless gloves who sold Georgian jewelry at the flea market, to rich people who wouldn't have been out of place at the barber's. Welty, I learned, had helped many of these people to build their collections by advising them what pieces to buy. Most of the conversation left me wholly at sea. Saint-Simon? Munich Opera Festival? Kumara Swami? The villa at Pau? But even when the rooms were formal and the company was smart, his lunches were the sort where people didn't seem to mind serving themselves or eating from plates in their laps, as opposed to the rigidly catered parties always tinkling frostily away at the barber's house. In fact, at these dinners, as agreeable and interesting as Hobie's guests were, I constantly worried that somebody who knew me from the barber's was going to turn up. I felt guilty for not calling Andy, and yet, After what had happened with his dad on the street, I felt even more ashamed for him to know that I'd washed up in the city again, with no place of my own to live. And, though it was a small matter enough, I was still bothered by how I'd turned up at Hobie's in the first place. Though he never told the story in front of me, how I'd showed up on the doorstep, mainly because he could see how uncomfortable it made me, still he told people. Not that I blamed him. It was too good a story not to tell.
"It's so fitting if you knew Welty,"
said Hobie's great friend, Mrs. DeFreeze, a dealer in 19th-century watercolors who, for all her stiff clothes and strong perfumes, was a hugger and a cuddler, with the old ladyish habit of liking to hold your arm or pat your hand as she talked.
"Because, my dear, Welty was an agoramaniac. Loved people, you know, loved the marketplace. The to and fro of it. Deals, goods, conversation, exchange. It was that eeny bit of Cairo from his boyhood. I always said he would have been perfectly happy padding around in slippers and showing carpets in the souk. He had the antiquaire's gift, you know. He knew what belonged with whom. Someone would come in the shop, never intending to buy a thing, ducking in out of the rain, maybe, and he'd offer them a cup of tea, and they'd end up having a dining room table shipped to Des Moines. Or a student would wander in to admire, and he'd bring out just the little inexpensive print. Everyone was happy, do you know? He knew everybody wasn't in the position to come in and buy some big important piece. It was all about matchmaking, finding the right home."
"Well, and people trusted him," said Hobie, coming in with Mrs. DeFreeze's thimble of sherry and a glass of whiskey for himself. "He always said his handicap was what made him a good salesman, and I think there's something to that. The sympathetic cripple. No axe to grind. Always on the outside, looking in."
"Ah, Welty was never on the outside of anything," said Mrs. DeFreeze,
accepting her glass of sherry and patting Hobie affectionately on the sleeve, her little paper-skinned hand glittering with rose-cut diamonds.
"He was always right in the thick of it, bless him, laughing that laugh. Never a word of complaint. Anyway, my dear," she said, turning back to me, "make no mistake about it. Welty knew exactly what he was doing by giving you that ring, because by giving it to you, he brought you straight here to Hobie, you see?"
"Right," I said, and then I'd had to get up and walk in the kitchen, so troubled was I by this detail. Because, of course, it wasn't just the ring he had given me. 8. At night, in Welty's old room, which was now my room, his old reading glasses and fountain pens still in the desk drawers, I lay awake listening to the street noise and fretting. It had crossed my mind in Vegas that if my dad or Zandra found the painting, they might not know what it was, at least not right away. But Hobie would know. Over and over, I found myself envisioning scenarios where I came home and found Hobie waiting for me with the painting in his hands.
"What's this?"
For there was no flim-flam, no excuse, no preemptive line with which to meet such a catastrophe. And when I got on my knees and reached under the bed to put my hands on the pillowcase, as I did blindly and at erratic interludes to make sure it was still there, it was a quick faint and drop, like grabbing at a too-hot microwave dinner. A house fire. An exterminator visit. Big red Interpol on the missing arts database. If anyone cared to make the connection, Welty's ring was proof positive that I'd been in the room with the painting. The door to my room was so old and uneven on its hinges that it didn't even catch properly. I had to prop it shut with an iron doorstop. What if, driven by some unanticipated impulse, he took it in his head to come upstairs and clean? Admittedly, this seemed out of character for the absent-minded and not particularly tidy Hobie I knew. "No, he doesn't care if you are messy. He never goes in my room except to change sheets and dust," Pippa had texted, prompting me to strip my bed immediately and spend 45 frantic minutes dusting every surface in my room, the griffins, the crystal ball, the headboard of the bed, with a clean t-shirt. Dusting soon became an obsessive habit, enough that I went out and bought my own dust cloths, even though Hobie had a house full of them. I didn't want him to see me dusting. My only hope was that the word dust would never occur to him if he happened to poke his head in my room. For this reason, because I was really only comfortable leaving the house in his company for long periods of time, I spent most of my days in my room, at my desk, with scarcely a break for meals. And when he went out, I tagged along with him to galleries, estate sales, showrooms, auctions, where I stood with him in the very back. "No, no," he said when I pointed out the empty chairs in front. "We want to be where we can see the paddles." Exciting at first, just like the movies, though after a couple of hours as tedious as anything in calculus, concepts, and connections. But though I tried, with some success, to act blasé, trailing him indifferently around Manhattan, as if I didn't care one way or another, in truth I stuck to him in much the same anxious spirit that Popchick, desperately lonely, had followed along constantly behind Boris and me in Vegas. I went with him to snooty lunches. I went with him on appraisals. I went with him to his tailor. I went with him to poorly attended lectures on obscure Philadelphia cabinet makers of the 1770s. I went with him to the opera orchestra, even though the programs were so boring and dragged on so long that I feared I might actually black out and topple into the aisle. I went with him to dinner with the Amstises on Park Avenue, uncomfortably close to the Barbers, and the Vogels and the Krasnows and the Mildebergers, where the conversation was either A, so eye-crossingly dull, or B, so far over my head that I could never manage much more than,
"Poor boy, we must be hopelessly uninteresting to you," said Mrs. Mildeberger brightly, not appearing to realize how truly she spoke.
Other friends, like Mr. Abernathy, my dad's age, with some ill-articulated scandal or disgrace in his past, were so mercurial and articulate, so utterly dismissive of me.
"And where did you say you obtained this child, James?"
That I sat dumbfounded among the Chinese antiquities and Greek vases, wanting to say something clever while at the same time terrified of having his attention turned on me, feeling tongue-tied and completely at sea. At least once or twice a week we went to Mrs. DeFries in her antique-packed townhouse, the uptown analog of Hobie's, on East 63rd, where I sat on the edge of a spindly chair and tried to ignore her frightening Bengal cats digging their claws in my knees.
"He's a socially alert little creature, isn't he?"
I heard her remark not so sotto voce when they were across the room fussing over some Edward Lear watercolors. Sometimes she accompanied us to the showings at Christie's and Sotheby's, Hobie poring over every piece, opening and shutting drawers, showing me various points of workmanship, marking up his catalog with a pencil. And then, after a stop or two at a gallery along the way, she went back to 63rd Street, and we went to St. Ambrose, where Hobie, in his smart suit, stood at the counter and drank an espresso, while I ate a chocolate croissant and looked at the kids with book bags coming in and hoped I didn't see anyone I knew from my old school.
"Would your dad like another espresso?"
the counterman asked when Hobie excused himself to go to the gents.
"No, thanks. I think just the check."
It thrilled me, deplorably, when people mistook Hobie for my parent. Though he was old enough to be my grandfather, he projected a vigor more in keeping with older European dads you saw on the East Side. Polished, portly, self-possessed dads on their second marriages who'd had kids at 50 and 60. To see him in his gallery-going clothes, sipping his espresso and looking out peacefully at the street, he might have been a Swiss industrial magnate or a restaurateur with a Michelin star or two. Substantial, late married, prosperous.
Why, I thought sadly, as he returned with his top coat over his arm, why hadn't my mother married someone like him? Or Mr. Bracegirdle? Somebody she actually had something in common with.
Older, maybe, but personable. Someone who enjoyed galleries and string quartets and poking around used bookstores. Someone attentive, cultivated, kind,
who would have appreciated her and bought her pretty clothes and taken her to Paris for her anniversary and given her the life she deserved. It wouldn't have been hard for her to find someone like that if she'd tried. Men had loved her, from the doormen to my school teachers to the fathers of my friends, right on up to her boss Sergio at work, who had called her, for reasons unknown to me, Dolly Bird. And even Mr. Barber had always been quick to jump up and greet her when she came to pick me up from sleepovers, quick with the smiles and quick to touch her elbow as he steered her to the sofa, voice low and companionable. "Won't you sit down? Would you like a drink, a cup of tea, anything?" I did not think it was my imagination. Not quite. How closely Mr. Bracegirdle had looked at me. Almost as if he was looking at her, or looking for some trace of her ghost in me. Yet even in death, my dad was ineradicable, no matter how hard I tried to wish him out of the picture. For there he always was, in my hands, and my voice, and my walk, in my darting sideways glance as I left the restaurant with Hobie. The very set of my head, recalling his old preening habit of checking himself out in any mirror-like surface. 9. In January, I had my tests, the easy one and the hard one. The easy one was in a high school classroom in the Bronx. Pregnant moms, assorted cab drivers, and a raucous gaggle of Grand Concourse homegirls with short fur jackets and sparkle fingernails. But the test was not actually so easy as I thought it would be, with a lot more questions about arcane matters of New York State government than I'd anticipated. How many months of the year was the legislature in Albany in session? How the hell was I supposed to know? And I came home on the subway preoccupied and depressed. And the hard test, locked classroom, uptight parents pacing the hallways, the strained atmosphere of a chess tournament, seemed to have been designed with some twitching MIT-bred recluse in mind, with many of the multiple-choice answers so similar that I came away with literally no idea how I'd done. "So what?" I told myself, walking up to Canal Street to catch the train, with my hands shoved deep in my pockets and my armpits rank with anxious classroom perspiration. Maybe I wouldn't get into the early college program, and what if I didn't? I had to do well, very well, in the top 30%, if I stood any chance at all. Hubris, a vocabulary word that had featured prominently on my pretests, though it hadn't shown up on the tests proper. I was competing with 5,000 applicants for something like 300 places. If I didn't make the cut, I wasn't sure what would happen. I didn't think I could bear it if I had to go to Massachusetts and stay with these Ungerer people Mr. Bracegirdle kept talking about, this good guy headmaster and his crew, as Mr. Bracegirdle called them, mom and three boys, whom I imagined as a slab-like, stair-stepped, whitely smiling line of the same prep school hoods who with cheerful punctuality in the bad old days had beaten up Andy and me and made us eat dust balls off the floor. But if I failed the test, or more accurately, didn't do quite well enough to make the early college program, how would I be able to work things so I could stay in New York? Certainly I should have aimed for a more achievable goal. Some decent high school in the city where I would have had at least a chance of getting in. Yet Mr. Bracegirdle had been so adamant about boarding school, about fresh air and autumn color and starry skies and the many joys of country life. Stuyvesant. Why would you stay here and go to Stuyvesant when you could get out of New York? Stretch your legs, breathe a bit easier, be in a family situation. That I'd stayed away from high schools altogether, even the very best ones. "I know what your mother would have wanted for you, Theodore," he'd said repeatedly. "She would have wanted a fresh start for you, out of the city." He was right, but how could I explain to him, in the chain of disorder and senselessness that had followed her death, exactly how irrelevant those old wishes were? Still lost in thought as I turned the corner to the station, fishing in my pocket for my Metro card, I passed a newsstand where I saw a headline reading, "Museum Masterworks Recovered in Bronx, Millions in Stolen Art." I stopped on the sidewalk, commuters streaming past me on either side. Then, stiffly, feeling observed, heart pounding, I walked back and bought a copy. Certainly buying a newspaper was a less suspicious thing for a kid my age to do than it seemed to be, and ran across the street to the benches on 6th Avenue to read it. Police, acting on a tip, had recovered three paintings, a George Vandermeer, a Vibrand Hendrix, and a Rembrandt, all missing from the museum since the explosion. From a Bronx home. The paintings had been found in a storage area, wrapped in tinfoil and stacked amidst a bunch of spare filters for the building's central air conditioning unit. The thief, his brother, and the brother's mother-in-law, owner of the premises, were in custody pending bail. If convicted on all charges, they faced combined sentences of up to 20 years. It was a pages-long article, complete with timelines and diagram. The thief, a paramedic, had lingered after the call to evacuate, removed the paintings from the wall, draped them with a sheet, concealed them beneath a folded-up portable stretcher, and walked with them from the museum, unobserved. Chosen with no eye to value, said the FBI investigator interviewed for the article. Snatch and grab. The guy didn't know a thing about art. Once he got the paintings home, he didn't know what to do with them, so he consulted with his brother, and together they hid the works at the mother-in-law's, without her knowledge, according to her. After a little internet research, the brothers had apparently realized that the Rembrandt was too famous to sell, and it was their efforts to sell one of the lesser-known works which led investigators to the cache in the attic. But the final paragraph of the article leaped out, as if it had been printed in red. As for other art still missing, the hopes of investigators have been revived, and authorities are now looking into several local leads. The more you shake the trees, the more falls out of them, said Richard Nunnally, city police liaison with the FBI Art Crimes Unit. Generally, with art theft, the pattern is for pieces to be whisked out of the country very quickly. But this find in the Bronx only goes to confirm that we probably have quite a few amateurs at work, inexperienced parties who stole on impulse and don't have the know-how to sell or conceal these objects. According to Nunnally, a number of people present at the scene are being questioned, contacted, and re-investigated. Obviously now, the thinking is that a lot of these missing pictures may be here in the city, right under our noses. I felt sick. I got up and dumped the paper in the nearest trash can and, instead of getting on the subway, wandered back down Canal Street and roamed around Chinatown for an hour in the freezing cold. Cheap electronics and blood-red carpets in the dim sum parlors, staring in fogged windows at mahogany racks of rotisseried Peking duck and thinking, shit, shit. Red-cheeked street vendors bundled like Mongolians, shouting above smoky braziers. District Attorney, FBI, new information. We are determined to prosecute these cases to the fullest extent of the law. We have full confidence that other missing works will surface soon. Interpol, UNESCO, and other federal and international agencies are cooperating with local authorities in the case. It was everywhere. All the newspapers had it, even the Mandarin newspapers, the recovered Rembrandt portrait amid streams of Chinese print, peeping out from bins of unidentifiable vegetables and eels on ice.
Really disturbing,
said Hobie later that night at dinner with the Amstises, brow knitted with anxiety. The recovered paintings were all he'd been able to talk about.
Wounded people everywhere, people bleeding to death, and here's this fellow snatching paintings off the walls, carrying them around outside in the rain.
Well, can't say I'm surprised, said Mr. Amstis, who was on his fourth scotch on the rocks.
After that second heart attack of Mother's, you can't believe the mess these goons from Beth Israel left. Black footprints all over the carpet. We were finding plastic needle caps all over the floor for weeks. The dog almost swallowed one. And they broke something, too. Martha, something in the china cabinet. What was it? Listen, you won't catch me complaining about paramedics, said Hobie. I was really impressed with the ones we had when Juliet was ill. I'm just glad they found the paintings before they were too badly damaged. It could have been a real...
Theo? He said to me, rather suddenly, causing me to glance up quickly from my plate.
Everything all right?
Sorry, I'm just tired.
No wonder, said Mrs. Amstis kindly.
She taught American history at Columbia. She, of the pair, was the one Hobie liked and was friends with, Mr. Amstis being the unfortunate half of the package.
You've had a tough day. Worried about your test?
No, not really,
I said, without thinking, and then was sorry.
Oh, I'm sure he'll get in, said Mr. Amstis. You'll get in, he said to me, in a tone implying that any idiot could expect to do so,
and then, turning back to Hobie,
most of these early college programs don't deserve the name. Isn't that right, Martha? Glorified high school. Tough pull to get in, but then a doddle once you've made it. That's the way it is these days with the kids. Participate, show up, and they expect a prize. Everybody wins. Do you know what one of Martha's students said to her the other day? Tell them, Martha. This kid comes up after class, wants to talk. Shouldn't say kid. Graduate student. And you know what he says?
Harold, said Mrs. Amstis.
Says he's worried about his test performance. Wants her advice. Because he has a hard time remembering things. Does that take the cake or what? Graduate student in American history? Hard time remembering things? Well, God knows I have a hard time remembering things, too, said Hobie affably,
and rising with the dishes, steered the conversation into other channels. But late that night, after the Amstises had left and Hobie was asleep, I sat up in my room staring out the window at the street, listening to the distant 2 a.m. grindings of trucks over on 6th Avenue, and doing my best to talk myself down from my panic. Yet what could I do? I'd spent hours on my laptop, clicking rapidly through what seemed like hundreds of articles, Le Monde, Daily Telegraph, Times of India, La Repubblica, languages I couldn't read. Every paper in the world was covering it. The fines, in addition to the prison sentence, were ruinous. $200,000, $500,000. Worse, the woman who owned the house was being charged because the paintings had been found on her property. And what this meant, very likely, was that Hobie would be in trouble too. Much worse trouble than me. The woman, a retired beautician, claimed she'd had no idea the paintings were in her house. But Hobie? An antiques dealer? Never mind that he'd taken me in innocently, out of the goodness of his heart. Who would believe he hadn't known about it? Up, down, and around my thoughts plunged, like a bad carnival ride. Though these thieves acted impulsively and have no prior criminal records, their inexperience will not deter us from prosecuting this case to the letter of the law. One commentator in London had mentioned my painting in the same breath with the recovered Rembrandt, has drawn attention to more valuable works still missing, most particularly Carol Fabricius's Goldfinch of 1654, unique in the annals of art, and therefore priceless. I reset the computer for the third or fourth time and shut it down, and then, a bit stiffly, climbed in bed and shut out the light. I still had the baggie of pills I'd stolen from Zandra, hundreds of them, all different colors and sizes, all painkillers, according to Boris. But though sometimes they knocked my dad out cold, I'd also heard him complaining about how sometimes they kept him awake at night. So, after lying paralyzed with discomfort and indecision for an hour or more, seasick and tossing, staring at the spokes of car lights wheeling across the ceiling, I snapped on the light again and scrabbled around in the nightstand drawer for the bag and selected two different colored pills, a blue and a yellow, my reasoning being that if one didn't put me to sleep, the other might. Priceless. I rolled to face the wall. The recovered Rembrandt had been valued at 40 million, but 40 million was still a price. Out on the avenue, a fire engine screamed high and hard before trailing into the distance. Cars, trucks, loudly laughing couples coming out of the bars, as I lay awake trying to think of calming things like snow and stars in the desert, hoping I hadn't swallowed the wrong mix and accidentally killed myself. I did my best to hold tight to the one helpful or comforting fact I'd gleaned from my online reading. Stolen paintings were almost impossible to trace unless people tried to sell them or move them, which was why only 20% of art thieves were ever caught. Chapter 8. The Shop Behind the Shop. Continued. 1. Such was my terror and anxiety about the painting that it overshadowed, somewhat, the arrival of the letter. I'd been accepted for the spring term of my early college program. The news was so shocking that I put the envelope in a desk drawer, where it sat alongside a stack of Welty's monogrammed letter paper for 2 days, until I worked up the nerve to go to the head of the stairs, brisk scratch of handsaw floating up from the shop, and say, "Hobie." The saw stopped. "I got in." Hobie's large, pale face appeared at the foot of the stairs. "What's that?" he said, still in his work trance, not quite there, wiping his hands and leaving white handprints on his black apron. And then his expression changed when he saw the envelope. "Is that what I think it is?" Without a word, I handed it to him. He looked at it, then at me, then laughed what I thought of as his Irish laugh, harsh and surprised at itself. "Well done, you," he said, untying his apron and slinging it across the railing of the stairs. "I'm glad about it. I won't lie to you. I hated to think of packing you up there all on your own. And when were you going to mention it? Your first day of school?" It made me feel terrible how pleased he was. At our celebratory dinner, me, Hobie, and Mrs. DeFries, at a struggling little neighborhood Italian, I looked at the couple drinking wine at the only other occupied table besides our own, and, instead of being happy, as I'd hoped, felt only irritated and numb.
"Cheers," said Hobie. "The tough part is over. You can breathe a little easier now."
"You must be so pleased," said Mrs. DeFries,
who all night long had been linking her arm through mine and giving little squeezes and chirrups of delight.
"You look bien élégant," Hobie had said to her when he kissed her on the cheek,
gray hair piled atop her head and velvet ribbons threaded through the links of her diamond bracelet.
"Model of dedication," said Hobie to her.
It made me feel even worse about myself, hearing him tell his friends how hard I'd worked and what an excellent student I was.
"Well, it's wonderful. Aren't you pleased? And on such short notice, too. Do try to look a bit happier, my dear." "When does he start?" she said to Hobie.
2. The pleasant surprise was that after the trauma of getting in, the early college program wasn't nearly as rigorous as I'd feared. In certain respects, it was the least demanding school I'd ever attended. No AP classes, no hectoring about SATs and Ivy League admissions, no backbreaking math and language requirements. In fact, no requirements at all. With increasing bewilderment, I looked around at the geeky academic paradise I'd tumbled into and realized why so many gifted and talented high school kids in 5 boroughs had been knocking themselves senseless to get into this place. There were no tests, no exams, no grades. There were classes where you built solar panels and had seminars with Nobel-winning economists, and classes where all you did was listen to Tupac records or watch old episodes of Twin Peaks. Students were free to concoct their own robotics or history of gaming tutorials if they so chose. I was free to pick and choose among interesting electives with only some take-home essay questions at midterm and a project at the end. But though I knew just how lucky I was, still it was impossible to feel happy or even grateful for my good fortune. It was as if I'd suffered a chemical change of the spirit, as if the acid balance of my psyche had shifted and leached the life out of me in aspects impossible to repair or reverse, like a frond of living coral hardened to bone. I could do what I had to. I'd done it before. Gone blank. Pushed forward. 4 mornings a week, I rose at 8, showered in the clawfoot tub in the bath off Pippa's bedroom, dandelion shower curtain, the smell of her strawberry shampoo wafting me up into a mocking vapor where her presence smiled all around me. Then, abrupt plunge to earth, I exited the cloud of steam and dressed silently in my room and, after dragging Popchick around the block, where he darted to and fro and screamed in terror, ducked my head into the workshop, said goodbye to Hobie, hoisted my backpack over my shoulder, and took the train 2 stops downtown. Most kids were taking 5 or 6 courses, but I went for the minimum, 4. Studio art, French, intro to European cinema, Russian literature in translation. I'd wanted to take conversational Russian, but Russian 101, the introductory level, wasn't available until the fall. With knee-jerk coldness, I showed up for class, spoke when spoken to, completed my assignments, and walked back home. Sometimes after class, I ate in cheap Mexican and Italian places around NYU with pinball machines and plastic plants, sports on the widescreen television, and dollar beer at happy hour, though no beer for me. It was weird readjusting to my life as a minor, like going back to crayons and kindergarten. Afterwards, all sugared up from unlimited refill sprites, I walked back to Hobie's through Washington Square Park with my head down and my iPod turned loud. Because of anxiety, the recovered Rembrandt was still all over the news. I was having big problems sleeping, and whenever the doorbell at Hobie's rang unexpectedly, I jumped as if at a 5-alarm fire.
"You're missing out, Theo,"
said Susanna, my counselor. First names only. All pals.
Extracurricular activities are what anchor our students in an urban campus, our younger students especially. It can be easy to get lost.
Well, she was right. School was lonely. The 18 and 19-year-olds didn't socialize with the younger kids, and though there were plenty of students my age and younger, even one spindly 12-year-old rumored to have an IQ of 260, their lives were so cloistered and their concerns so foolish and foreign-seeming that it was as if they spoke some lost middle school tongue I'd forgotten. They lived at home with their parents. They worried about things like grade curves and Italian abroad and summer internships at the UN. They freaked out if you lit a cigarette in front of them. They were earnest, well-meaning, undamaged, clueless. For all I had in common with any of them, I might as well have tried to go down and hang out with the 8-year-olds at PS 41.
"I see you're taking French. The French club meets once a week, in a French restaurant on University Place.
And on Tuesdays they go up to the Alliance Française
and watch French language movies. That seems like something you might enjoy."
"Maybe." The head of the French department, an elderly Algerian, had already approached me, shockingly. At his large, firm hand on my shoulder, I jumped up like I was being mugged, and told me without preamble that he was teaching a seminar that I might like to sit in on, the roots of modern terrorism, starting with the FLN and the Guerre d'Algérie. I hated how all the teachers in the program seemed to know who I was, addressing me with apparent foreknowledge of the tragedy, as my cinema teacher, Mrs. Lebowitz,
"Call me Ruthie,"
had termed it. She too, Mrs. Lebowitz, had been after me to join the cinema club after reading an essay I'd written about the bicycle thief. She'd suggested as well that I might also enjoy the philosophy club, which entailed weekly discussion of what she called the big questions.
Maybe,
I said politely.
"Well, from your essay, it seems as if you were drawn to what I'll call, for lack of a better term, the metaphysical territory. Such as, why do good people suffer?"
she said, when I continued to look at her blankly.
"And is fate random? What your essay deals with is really not so much the cinematic aspect of De Sica as the fundamental chaos and uncertainty of the world we live in."
"I don't know," I said in the uneasy pause that fell. Was my essay really about these things? I hadn't even liked the bicycle thief. Or Kess, or Mouette, or Lacombe Lucienne, or any of the other extremely depressing foreign films we had watched in Mrs. Lebowitz's class. Mrs. Lebowitz looked at me so long, I felt uncomfortable. Then she adjusted her bright red eyeglasses and said,
"Well, most of what we do in European cinema is pretty heavy, which is why I'm thinking maybe you'd like to sit in on one of my seminars for film majors. Screwball comedies of the 30s, or maybe even silent cinema. We do Dr. Caligari, but also a lot of Buster Keaton, a lot of Charlie Chaplin. Chaos, you know, but in a non-threatening framework. Life-affirming stuff."
"Maybe," I said, but I had no intention of burdening myself with even one scrap of extra work, no matter how life-affirming in nature, for from almost the moment I'd gotten in the door, the deceptive burst of energy by which I had clawed my way into the early college program had collapsed. Its lavish offerings left me unmoved. I had no desire to exert myself one bit more than I absolutely had to. All I wanted was to scrape by. Consequently, the enthusiastic welcome of my teachers soon began to wane into resignation and a sort of vague, impersonal regret. I was not seeking out challenges, developing my skills, expanding my horizons, utilizing the many resources available to me. I was not, as Susanna had delicately put it, adjusting to the program. In fact, increasingly as the term wore on, as my teachers slowly distanced themselves and a more resentful note began to surface, the academic opportunities offered do not seem to spur Theodore to greater efforts on any front. I grew more and more suspicious that the only reason I'd been allowed into the program at all was because of the tragedy. Someone had flagged my application in the admissions office, passed it on to an administrator. My God, this poor kid, victim of terrorism, blah, blah, blah. School has a responsibility. How many places do we have left? Do you think we can fit him in? Almost certainly I had ruined the life of some deserving brainiac out in the Bronx, some poor clarinet-playing loser in the projects who was still getting beaten up for his algebra homework, who was going to end up punching tickets in a toll booth instead of teaching fluid mechanics at Caltech because I'd taken his or her rightful place. Clearly, a mistake had been made. Theodore participates very little in class and appears to have no desire to expend any more attention on his studies than absolutely necessary, wrote my French professor in a scathing midterm report that, in the absence of any closely supervising adult, no one saw but me. It is to be hoped that his failures will drive him to prove himself so that he may profit from his situation in the second half of the term. But I had no desire to profit from my situation, even less to prove myself. Like an amnesiac, I roam the streets and, instead of doing my homework or attending my language lab, or joining any of the clubs to which I'd been invited, rode the subway out to purgatorial end-of-the-line neighborhoods where I wandered alone among bodegas and hair-weave emporiums. But soon I lost interest even in my newfound mobility, hundreds of miles of track, riding just for the hell of it, and instead, like a stone sinking soundlessly into deep water, lost myself in idle work down in Hobie's basement. A welcoming drowsiness beneath the sidewalk, where I was insulated from the city blare and all the airborne bristle of office towers and skyscrapers, where I was happy to polish tabletops and listen to classical music on WNYC for hours on end. After all, what did I care about Passé Composé or the works of Turgenev? Was it wrong, wanting to sleep late with the covers over my head and wander around a peaceful house with old seashells in drawers and wicker baskets of folded upholstery fabric stored under the parlor secretary, sunset falling in drastic coral spokes through the fanlight over the front door? Before long, between school and workshop, I had slipped into a sort of forgetful doze, a skewed, dreamlike version of my former life, where I walked familiar streets yet lived in unfamiliar circumstances, among different faces. And though often walking to school I thought of my old, lost life with my mother, Canal Street Station, lighted bins of flowers at the Korean market, anything could trigger it.
It was as if a black curtain had come down on my life in Vegas. Only sometimes, in unguarded moments, it struck through in such mutinous bursts that I stopped mid-step on the sidewalk, amazed. Somehow the present had shrunk into a smaller and much less interesting place. Maybe it was just I'd sobered up a bit. No longer the chronic waste and splendor of those blazing adolescent drunks. Our own little warrior tribe of two rampaging in the desert. Maybe this was just how it was when you got older. Although it was impossible to imagine Boris in Warsaw, Karmiwalag, New Guinea, wherever, living a sedate prelude to adulthood life such as the one I'd fallen into. Andy and I, even Tom Cable and I, had always talked obsessively about what we were going to be when we grew up. But with Boris, the future had never appeared to enter his head any further than his next meal. I could not envision him preparing in any way to earn a living or to be a productive member of society. And yet, to be with Boris was to know that life was full of great, ridiculous possibilities, far bigger than anything they taught in school. I'd long ago given up trying to text him or call. Messages to Kotku's phone went unanswered. His home number in Vegas had been disconnected. I could not imagine, given his wide sphere of movement, that I would ever see him again. And yet I thought of him almost every day. The Russian novels I had to read for school reminded me of him. Russian novels, and Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and so too the Lower East Side, tattoo parlors and pierogi shops, pot in the air, old Polish ladies swaying side to side with grocery bags, and kids smoking in the doorways of bars along Second Avenue. And, sometimes, unexpectedly, with a sharpness that was almost pain, I remembered my father. Chinatown made me think of him, in its flash and seediness, its slippery, unreadable moods, mirrors and fish tanks, shop windows with plastic flowers and pots of lucky bamboo. Sometimes, when I walked down to Canal Street for Hobie to buy Rotten Stone and Venice Turpentine at Pearl Paint, I ended up drifting over to Mulberry Street to a restaurant my dad had liked, not far from the E-train, 8 stairs down to a basement with stained formica tables where I bought crispy scallion pancakes, spicy pork, dishes I had to point at because the menu was in Chinese. The first time I'd showed up at Hobie's laden with greasy paper bags, his blank expression had stopped me cold, and I stood in the middle of the floor like a sleepwalker awakened mid-dream, wondering what exactly I'd been thinking. Not of Hobie, certainly. He wasn't the person who craved Chinese food all hours of the day and night.
"Oh, I do like it," said Hobie hastily. "Only I never think of it."
And we ate downstairs in the shop straight from the cartons, Hobie seated atop a stool in his black work apron and sleeves rolled to the elbow, the chopsticks oddly small-looking in his large fingers. 3. The informal nature of my stay at Hobie's worried me, too. Though Hobie himself, in his foggy beneficence, didn't appear to mind me at his house, Mr. Bracegirdle clearly viewed it as a temporary arrangement, and both he and my counselor at school had taken great pains to explain that though the dormitories of my college were reserved for older students, something could be worked out in my case. But whenever the topic of living arrangements came up, I fell silent and stared at my shoes. The residence halls were crowded, fly-specked, with a graffiti-scrawled cage lift that clanked like a prison elevator, walls papered with banned flyers, floors sticky with spilled beer, zombified mob of blanket-wrapped hulks drowsing on the sofas in the TV room, and wasted-looking guys with facial hair, grown men in my view, big, scary guys in their 20s, throwing empty 40-ounce cans at each other in the hall.
"Well, you're still a bit young," said Mr. Bracegirdle.
When, cornered, I expressed my reservations, although the true reason for my reservations was something I couldn't discuss. How, given my circumstances, could I possibly live with a roommate? What about security? Sprinkler systems? Theft? "The school is not responsible for the personal property of students," said the handbook I'd been given.
we recommend that students take out a dorm insurance policy upon any valuable objects that may be accompanying them to school. In a trance of anxiety, I threw myself into the task of being indispensable to Hobie.